TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Palestine and the Universality of Human Rights. On September 25th, 2003, a message made its way around the world. Edward Said, Palestinian-American, world-famous professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University, and fearless defender of the Palestinian cause, had died of leukemia in New York City, far from the city of Jerusalem, where he was born in 1935. This is a tribute to Edward Said, with excerpts from his last major talk on Palestine, recorded by TUC Radio only 7 months before his death. By 1950, Edward Said's extended family had all fled from Jerusalem to Cairo. Like hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, they were displaced by Israel that had been established 2 years earlier. Later, Said came to the U.S., studied at Princeton and Harvard, and went on to teach at Yale and Columbia. Said was a prominent member of the Palestinian Parliament in exile for 14 years, until he quietly stepped down in 1991. He had broken with Yasser Arafat and was critical of what he called his corrupt leadership. Said paid dearly for his advocacy of Palestinian sovereignty. He received death threats and his office was firebombed. Even in his dying days, an attempt was made by a supporter of Israel to deprive him of his academic job at Columbia. TUC Radio recorded Edward Said's speech at UC Berkeley in February of 2003, his last major public address before his death 7 months later. He spoke to over 2,000 people and received a standing ovation. Here is the voice of Edward Said.
I'm incredibly moved and flattered, first of all, to have been invited here in the first place. Second, to see all of you here tonight. My topic tonight is Palestine and the universality of human rights. This is a very fraught moment to be speaking about human rights in the Middle East, and those of the Palestinian people in particular. But it does seem to me a symbolically useful time for the purposes of my lecture. Given that since World War II, there has grown up an impressive, even formidable, worldwide consensus that each individual or collectivity, no matter his or her color, ethnicity, religion, or culture, is to be protected from such horrific practices as starvation, torture, forced transfer of population, discrimination on the basis of religion or ethnos, humiliation, extrajudicial political assassinations, land expropriations, and all manner of similar cruel and unusual punishment. I want to affirm also that no power, no matter how special or how developed or how strong or how urgent its claims of past victimization, is exempt from accusation and judgment if that government practices such things. Once big powers start to dream of regime change, a process already begun by the Pearls and Wolfowitzes of this country, there's simply no end in sight. Isn't it outrageous that people of such a dubious caliber actually go on blathering about bringing democracy, modernization, and liberalization to the Middle East? Heaven knows that the area needs it, as so many Arab and Muslim intellectuals and ordinary people have said over and over. But who appointed these characters as agents of progress anyway? And what entitles them to pontificate in so shameless a way when there are already so many injustices and abuses in our own country to be remedied? Colin Powell's speech at the UN, despite its many weaknesses, its plagiarized and manufactured evidence, was correct in one thing. Saddam Hussein's regime has violated numerous human rights and UN resolutions. There can be no arguing about that. and no excuses. But what is so tremendously hypocritical about the official U.S. position is that literally everything Powell has accused the Iraqi Baathis of has been the stock and trade of every Israeli government since 1948. And at no time more flagrantly since the occupation of 1967. Torture, illegal detention, assassination, assaults against civilians with missiles, helicopters and jet fighters, the annexation of territory, the transportation of civilians from one place to another for the purpose of imprisonment, mass killing, as in Khana, Jenin, Sabra and Shatila, to mention only the most obvious, the denial of rights to free passage and unimpeded civilian movement, education, medical aid, the use of civilians for human shields, humiliation, punishment of families, house demolitions on a mass scale, destruction of agricultural land, expropriation of water, illegal settlements, economic pauperization, attacks on hospitals, medical workers and ambulances, the killing of UN personnel, to name only the most outrageous abuses. All these, it should be noted with emphasis, have been carried on with the total, unconditional support of the United States, which has not only supplied Israel with the weapons for such practices and every kind of military and intelligence aid, but has also given Israel upwards of $135 billion in economic aid on a scale that beggars the relative amount per capita spent by our government on its own citizens. This is an unconscionable record to hold against the U.S. and the Secretary of State as its human symbol in particular. As the person in charge of U.S. foreign policy, it's his specific responsibility to uphold the laws of this country and to make sure that the enforcement of human rights and the promotion of freedom is applied uniformly without exception or condition. How he and his co-workers can stand up before the world and righteously sermonize against Iraq while at the same time completely ignoring the ongoing American partnership in human rights abuses with Israel defies credibility. And yet no one in all the justified critiques of the U.S. position has focused on this point. And that is what I want to do this evening. History is made by men and women. And the world we live in is a secular and historical world as a result. History is therefore the product of human labor, choice, and will. Nothing transcendental or divine can supersede that truth or suspend the consequences that flow from its application. There simply is no convincing way to assert special claims whose origin is the divine, claims that supposedly legitimate high altitude or smart bombing or the use of 60-ton bulldozers to demolish the houses of poor and defenseless people who don't happen to belong to the right religion or race. Just as I feel as an American that the United States has not been divinely endowed with a special errand into the wilderness and that its practices are endorsed by God, I feel it's my moral and intellectual duty to oppose the unjust use of its immense military, economic, and political power abroad for what is, it claims falsely, to be its national security interests. The specific case of the denial of the human rights of the Palestinian people by the State of Israel cannot at all be justified on any of the grounds routinely accepted by far too many individuals and governments who would be the first to object to similar behavior in other cases. So far from Israel and the Palestinians being a special case of unusual circumstances, I think the exact opposite is true, that because Palestine is perhaps of all places on earth the one most densely saturated with cultural and religious significance, precisely that reality makes it an instance of universality thwarted and flouted. The universality of human coexistence, human acceptance of the other, and the human construction of a just and fair society for all, and certainly not only some, of its residents. The point is that no state at all, is entitled legitimately to object to these formulations, and certainly no leader can state unarguably, as General Sharon has announced, and I quote, "We are placing no restrictions on our operations in the Palestinian territories. Israel is under no pressure. No one is criticizing us or has the right to do so." I would submit that such sweeping statements of higher purpose and extraordinary impunity must be opposed and intellectually dismantled for the thuggish balderdash that such pronouncements really are, especially if they're intended to cover or explain or excuse or somehow justify barbaric devastation and vast ruin. But aside from comfort and convenience, human beings today expect, rightly, to be respected, their requirements for a decent life met, their wish recognized not to be tortured or to be detained unlawfully, their concern for their children and their livelihoods accepted despite the supposedly higher priorities asserted by great power. All these, in theory at least, are rarely challenged head-on and considered to be human entitlements, even if such terrible abstractions as the national interest and national unity are affirmed as superseding individual rights. This unattractive and unacceptable argument certainly now prevails in the U.S., where education and history, for example, has become a profoundly ideological battle between proponents of a kind of primitive, heroic, white American nationalism and the much more sensible advocates of the multicultural, multiracial realities stressed, for instance, in his work by the prominent historian Howard Zinn. This other American history includes a bitter legacy of domestic slavery, imperial conquest, and terrible class inequality. So the universally accepted widespread conviction that everyone on earth deserves a modicum of human rights has only a symbolic moral power, perhaps too ill-endowed to take on so redoubtable a force as American global reach and all its all too numerous local henchmen and fearsome neoconservative spokespeople who want so-called American values to rule the world, resistance and objections notwithstanding. To speak about Palestinian rights in so skewed a context, therefore, may seem quixotic. And certainly the current impression that Israel and the U.S. have borne all before them in their stubbornly ingrained hostility to Palestinian self-determination reinforces the superficial impression. But I want to argue that is not at all there is to the whole truth. There are other accomplishments and realities also to be noted with positive approbation and admiration. During my own lifetime, Palestinians, since the climactic events of 1948, when their society was destroyed and the establishment of Israel occurred, Palestinians have gone from the status of non-persons to that of a universally acknowledged national collectivity, i.e., a people, by virtue not of force of arms, but of other means, some of which I want to rehearse here. If for now Palestinians are still stateless, dispossessed, and for the most part exiled, it is because by those very unmilitary means, some of which are the mobilized force of memory, the power of images, and the heroism and ingenuity of sheer persistence, Palestinians embody perhaps the most visible and certainly the most universal case of human rights abuses on earth today. Note that in all the many different places, conditions, and politics that the approximately 7.5 million Palestinians now live in, as citizens of Israel, as people under military occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, as refugees and stateless persons in several Arab countries, as refugees with various acquired nationalities scattered all over the world, and as members of a dispossessed people, Palestinians have developed a moral and political solidarity with each other, nothing less, in fact, than a national identity, that it has been the goal of Israel to deny, obliterate, and refuse to acknowledge as sovereign. The overall plan, beginning in 1948, was to start Israel as if afresh, a state arising from nothing to take its place among the nations. In the affirmation of its renewed millennial identity, Israel managed for quite a while to remove the traces of Palestinian life for the most part. Much of the pre-state Zionist ideology that mobilized Eastern European communities for the trek to mandatory Palestine was premised on the virtual absence of inhabitants, on what was often depicted as either a completely empty or a hopelessly arid land awaiting redemption. Later, or in some cases simultaneously with that contention, when the discovery of actual Palestinians could no longer be deferred or denied, there was a concerted effort to devise ways of spiriting them away, for which the war of 1948 provided field commanders and David Ben-Gurion himself with a rich opportunity. These are amply attested to in the Israeli military archive, as combed assiduously by a number of Jewish as well as numerous Arab researchers, including Masalha himself. Since 1967, the desire to efface or repress what has remained of an institutionalized Palestinian life in the cities and villages of the West Bank and Gaza has remained an often explicitly stated Israeli goal, recently hidden inside the polemics of a war for Israel's survival and a defense against extremist terrorism. But whether its new Jewish citizens liked it or not, Israel was always encumbered by Palestinian memory, which is one of my themes here. It's not as if a whole existence of a people can be easily wiped away like a footprint in the sand. The sheer banality of such a possibility is too obvious to require more comment here. What I would like to note, however, is that as the resourceful Palestinian-Israeli sociologist Ahmed Saadi has shown in a brilliant piece of historical and social synthesis, the more Israel has unilaterally exerted its considerable force to bury the Palestinian past, as it were, there has been a painstaking collective and yet uncoordinated Palestinian memory that has maintained Palestinian history since the Nakba of 1948 as a tremendously potent site of memory. Cinema is one result. What has remained of the vastly dispersed and disjunctive fragments of history since 1948 have been painstakingly collected over time by individuals as objects of memory, such objects as house keys, title deeds, photographs, letters, newspaper clippings, embroideries, and so forth. And through film, fiction, poetry, oral discourse, critical and political analysis, significant or traumatic collective experiences like the Deir Yassin, Kfar Qasim, Sabra and Shatila, and Jenin events, the significant episodes of Palestinian suffering have been preserved along with a national life that bore and outlived them. In Lebanon, 400,000 Palestinians are kept stateless, their medical needs largely unattended to, their ability to work, study, and reside as they please, all of them universally accorded human rights. These are scandalously curtailed by statutory laws designed expressly for that purpose. In Syria and Egypt, similar conditions apply, only with smaller numbers of Palestinians involved. In countries where Palestinians have been fortunate enough to acquire citizenship, there are invidious laws that discriminate against them as somehow different from the rest of the population. This is sadly true even in this country. In the practice, for example, of racial profiling or singling out Palestinians in universities and in lines at the airport. Inside Israel, non-Jewish Palestinians are underrepresented. They are juridically not allowed rights of immigration, land ownership, and buying. These rights are automatically accorded to the Jewish citizen of the state and indeed of Jewish people everywhere in the world. Since late 2001, extra pressure on the Palestinians as a community has been applied to them inside Israel, even though they represent over 20% of Israel's population. As for the West Bank and Gaza in particular, the 35-year-old military occupation, now the longest and most brutally sustained in modern history, has taken a terrific toll in the human condition of the Palestinians on every level. In fact, short of genocide itself, I cannot think of a single one of their human rights as a people that has not been violated with a kind of refined viciousness designed to dehumanize, break their spirit, and humiliate them to a degree that is, even to someone who has been carefully but helplessly aware of this taking place, simply stupefying. The sheer inequality between the average Palestinian and the average Israeli is breathtaking. you will say something disapproving about those terrible suicide bombers, and I will agree. But how many Israelis have had to live through the demolition by bulldozing of entire villages, blocks of flats, shopping districts? How many Israelis have had to endure missile attacks by Apache helicopter or rockets from American-made F-16 fighters? How many Israelis have to be stripped and searched at 300 checkpoints on an hourly basis? During the first 3 weeks of the present Intifada, 1 million bullets were fired by Israeli military personnel at Palestinian civilians. Neither Indians demonstrating against the British nor South African blacks fighting against apartheid faced anything like this. 2 or 3 days ago, 12 Palestinians were killed as a result of an Israeli incursion into Gaza, dozens more injured, tens of houses demolished. In varying degrees of severity and brutality, this sort of thing has been going on there every day for 35 years, as in the meantime, dozens and dozens of new settlements have been set up on Palestinian land. Conversely, how many Palestinian settlements have infringed on Israeli property? How many daily armed incursions, sometimes with 60 tanks at a time, have penetrated Israeli towns and villages? How many Israeli fields have been burned? With all the ritual and fuss surrounding the planting of trees in Israel, does anyone bother to recall that an average of 896 Palestinian trees per day have been uprooted by Israeli settlers and soldiers since the beginning of the Intifada in October 2000. For this kind of brutalizing assault, the United States and Israel designed a peace process that lasted 10 years, which was not even supposed to put a stop to all this, but rather to make it seem slightly less unbearable. All of this has gone on with the full support of the United States and its passive taxpayers. If in the period after 1948, as part of the post-war reemergence of Europe, Israel had the status of a progressive cause, it is now Palestine that has taken that place. But since the first Intifada of 1987, Israel has been transformed dramatically into a symbol of oppression and injustice, lumped together with the United States for its imperial arrogance, its supremacist attitudes, and its inhumane policies towards the Palestinians over which it has ruled for so long. As of this moment, not a single major Israeli political or intellectual figure has articulated any serious contrition, to say nothing of accepting responsibility for the disastrous and sustained human suffering of the Palestinian people. I know nothing at all in contemporary history quite like this amazing stone wall of obduracy and denial. And yet, I must also say that the legacy of persecution, genocide, and anti-Semitism that is so much a part of Israel's history is a background to be figured in and contended with just the same. Two communities of sufferings, I've called them in the past, but one must, I think, make clear that at the present time, one community has a tremendous balance of power in its favor, the other is, so to speak, the victim of the former victim. Israeli policies, as well as the meditation of many Western liberals who feel a collective guilt for Christian and European anti-Semitism, nevertheless must be able to disentangle the past from the present, to make very clear distinctions between respecting the appalling past injustices heaped on Jews historically on the one hand, and on the other simply excusing what the state of the Jews has done to the entire Palestinian people ever since. There is simply no earthly or divine dispensation that would excuse a state or a people for wreaking havoc upon another while pleading through the travails of its own past as an excuse. My argument here that such claims do not at all correspond with universalism or the idea that human rights cannot be manipulated to accommodate what is a record of patent brutality and cruelty in the past. Palestinians have been displaced. They have had their society shattered. They have had to live under military occupation. Their lands and lives are today systematically torn apart. There are no two ways about it, I believe. Which is not to say that we must simply overlook the tragic history of the Jews. On the contrary, I would always want to say that as a Palestinian, I should make my case to defenders of Israel on the basis of taking full account of, making due acknowledgement of the history of discrimination against Jews. That kind of policy should never, ever be visited on anyone for any reason at all, least of all by Jews, in the name of their safety and independence. Separation between peoples, war between peoples, is not a solution for any of the problems that divide them. And certainly ignorance of the other provides no help whatever. I, for one, am full of optimism, despite the darkening sky and the seemingly hopeless situation for the time being that encloses us all. Thank you.
You heard excerpts from a 90-minute speech by the late Professor Edward Said. News of his untimely death in September of 2003 shook the world. He is missed as a loved and respected professor of literature, a musicologist and pianist, and an eloquent defender of Palestinian sovereignty. He leaves behind a treasure of writings, including his most influential book, Orientalism, an examination of the way the West perceives the Islamic world. He also wrote The Question of Palestine, Covering Islam After the Last Sky, and Blaming the Victims. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Edward Said on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a 90-minute copy of the complete talk by Edward Said, including the fascinating question and answer period, by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term, the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for the pilot to save the plane. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.